Michael Pento from Pento Portfolio Strategies. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Michael, what do you think is the most important factor that you're watching at the moment that shows the precariousness of the markets, the economy, or the world right now?
The most important factor, plural, that have me on edge and should have everybody who's competent, every competent investor on edge, as I've been saying now for years now, and it's just because it's been in existence for years doesn't mean that it's a figment of my imagination. It's a triumvirate of bubbles. So we have a massive credit bubble, a record real estate bubble, and a record stock bubble. That's not even my opinion. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm. Every credible metric known to mankind that measures the extent of those bubbles shows that we're in unprecedented territory, not just nominal terms. If I said to you, well, there's $100 trillion of U.S. debt, you go, okay, well, that's great. But always compare that to something, like compared to GDP. Mm-hmm. So total debt as a relative to GDP is at an all-time record high. Home prices are at a record high. Okay, but what about incomes? Well, the home price to income ratio is at a record high, higher than it was at the peak of the housing bubble. Mm-hmm. The total market cap of equities is at a record high. Big deal. Okay, but the total market cap of equities as a percentage of GDP is at an all-time record high, and by a whole heck of a lot, way above the mean. You know, the average of that rate, the averages of those ratios are just so far below where they currently exist. And you look at the record number of households, that record household debt into equities, record margin debt, record ownership of equities. So it's a bubble. And the reason why it hasn't popped already is because we've had the biggest maniac money printer that the Federal Reserve has ever had as a Fed chairman. It was Jerome Powell. Mm-hmm. You know, after printing trillions and trillions of dollars post-COVID, $4.5 trillion post-COVID, this gentleman printed $193 billion after he ended quantitative tightening in December of last year. Let me say that again. $193, not dollars, not millions of dollars, billion dollars, $193 billion. So he was on a $40 billion per month massive QE program, and it was kind of like tacit. He didn't call it QE. He called it, you know, building reserves in the banking system, make sure there were ample reserves. Okay, well, thank you very much. You're printing money. You're destroying the purchasing power of the dollar. Thank you very much. And you also cut rates three times. And here's the ironic thing is he, Mr. Trump, who I voted for, wanted him gone, wanted to fire the head of the Federal Reserve, not for destroying the middle class and the purchasing power of the dollar, because he wasn't doing it fast enough. That's the truth.
Good way to put it. So, Michael, when we look at the expansion of the balance sheet, mm-hmm. and the expansion of basically the economy as well during that time, is this kind of, you know, is this an amount that is equal to the expansion in the economy at the same time?
No, I mean, money supply is growing leaps and bounds ahead of a labor force growth plus productivity growth mm-hmm. leaps and bounds. Listen, inflation is up 30% since 2020. That's the way they count, the way that the government counts inflation, up 30%. It's in real terms, you know, before. You know, pre-Boskin metrics show it much higher, but 30%. And whose income has increased by a third in the last few years? Not many. Mm-hmm. Not many. And if you're retired, your income hasn't gone up. If you're underemployed or unemployed, your income hasn't gone up. That's why there's a gigantic trenchant chasm developing in this country between the have and have nots, between that, you know, that dot on the I of the top maybe 20%, 10% of wage earners, and then the rest is a lowercase I that's headed right into the dirt. Really, really, that's why the sentiment is so low in this country, because we destroyed the middle class. You know, you know, we've gotten very wealthy, people who have houses and they've had nice stock accounts and they derive their wealth from assets, they're doing fine. But people who don't have, you know, rent for a living or don't have a lot of assets, they've been absolutely destroyed. They cannot afford – a first-time home has been priced out of their reach, and that's just disgusting. And the idea is to get the ball rolling, you know, a little faster down the hill for the dollar. That's why I have a tremendous amount of confidence or faith or hope. I guess the best word to use is hope, Tom, that Kevin Warsh can do something about this balance sheet. He's got to stop the QE. He's got to reverse the growth of that balance sheet and shrink it back to where we have scarce reserves, a bracketed reserves. So it's, you know, it's the discount window and then interest on excess reserves. I don't want to get into the weeds, but anyway, banks aren't sitting on so much reserves that there's no need for them to borrow in the repo market. They just gamble on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. That's got to stop. We got to, if we want to have a viable middle class, I'm a libertarian in my blood. So I'm not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican and I'm certainly not a liberal. But these liberals have one good point, is there shouldn't be such a huge wealth disparity. And I place that blame directly at the feet of the Federal Reserve. And don't tell me it's just because, you know, the Federal Reserve is supposed to be an independent party. Just because Congress spends like drunken monkeys doesn't mean that the Federal Reserve has to enable that practice. Mm-hmm.
Michael, is the expansion of the stock market at this point, and as you mentioned, the idea that anybody with assets is doing fine, is this all due to the liquidity that is being pumped in the system? And what happens if Warsh is able to get a handle on that?
I think you know, it's interest rate repression that helped engender this credit bubble. So look at total business debt. Total business debt net right now is $22 trillion. It's 70% of GDP. The private credit market, the private equity, that's the nucleus of the bubble. So we have to do something to address that debt. But the reason why we have all that debt is because of interest rate repression. The Fed is printing money, they buy bonds, and that forces interest rates down. And you have this, you know, warping of asset prices, because you know when you can borrow money for a mortgage at 2%, and home prices are going up 20%, what does Blackstone do? What does Wall Street do? They go buy up every single family home that they can, mm-hmm. and price out the public. So it's all at the feet of the Federal Reserve. And listen, we have so much debt in this country right now that, you know, we have $100 trillion of total debt. I didn't even talk about unfunded liabilities. That's public debt and private debt, $100 trillion, including financial debt. So every 1% up in interest rates, you're paying $1 trillion of interest expense. And we're in a big trouble. And here's where I think someone should be asking themselves, so when does this end? How does this all end? Well, first of all, it could end in two ways. Excuse me. Kevin Warsh could really start to shrink that balance sheet, getting excess reserves down to where they become scarce. Stop the gambling on Wall Street, and we could have a very healthy and cathartic and well-needed recession, which brings down these asset prices. That's kind of like a pipe dream. I don't want to be quixotic in nature, but I mean, I would hope that he would be able to stay the course. But once those reserves become scarce and they have some repo market problems, I'm afraid to say Warsh is probably going to blink under that pressure. And plus, he's only one man. He's the head of the Fed, but it's not a dictatorship there. It's a committee. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. Mr. Market might finally put an end to this nonsense, because after decades of debt and inflation, it's finally starting to get out of hand, where you see the anchor for long-term bond yields is disappeared. So Japanese government bonds right now, they're trading at a 30-year high yield. Mm-hmm. Japanese bond market used to be an anchor for yields. You say, well, you know what? Well, they have a zero interest rate policy there, going out over, you know, even to their benchmark 10-year rate. So that puts a limit on our rates. Well, that's gone. The German Bund, which is also an anchor, is up to a 15-year high. And that has caused U.S. yields now to be at a 19-year high. And the reason is they're rising is because we have this we have an intractable inflation problem, just not dealing with it. A lot of that, I know, I get it. The war in Iran exacerbated the problem, but we haven't been at 2% for 5 years, Tom, inflation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the war in Iran is exacerbating the problem, but we still have a problem of inflation. And on top of that, we have an insolvency issue. We just have so much debt outstanding, and the amount of rollovers and new issuances, it's a tsunami of debt. So without the Fed buying that debt and taking it out of the public domain, you know, sequestering it on his balance sheet, interest rates would be a function of market forces. And we just don't have the savings. And the foreigners, Tom, the foreigners don't want our debt either. You know, because of sanctions and confiscations, they're like, wait a second, why am I recycling my trade surplus into your bond market when you could just tell me that, you know, by the way, that money that you have with us, it's not yours. We're confiscating it. Mm-hmm. So there's a trust factor there. Also, you know, because of the tariffs, we have less international trade. So there's less of a need to even recycle it, of that trade surplus into our bond market. So for a lot of reasons, interest rates, instead of going down for like 40 years since 1980 to 2020, that 40-year bull market in bonds is over. Our bond prices up, yields down. It's the reverse now. I think it's a protracted and intractable trend higher.
So with yields blowing out all over the world, not only the US, does this set us up, especially considering the constraints of the war, does this set us up for a possibility of double digit rates? And, you know, what is the ability of the Fed to continue to operate in an environment where, or if we even get to double digit rates?
Double digit inflation rates or double digit bond rates?
Bond rates.
Well, you know, it's not, yeah, you know, people, I hear people all the time say, well, we have the deepest, most liquid bond market in the world and rates could never go up. Well, it's not really like a thought experiment. I mean, what were they in 1980? Right? Mm-hmm. Didn't interest rates go to like 15% in the bond market? So in treasury complex. So yeah, of course they could go to double digits. Just because we're the most liquid and deepest bond market in the planet, that doesn't mean that rates can't go up. If inflation goes back to 9% where it was post-COVID, and I have every reason to believe that it will eventually get there, of course we'll have double digit inflation and we'll have double digit bond rates. And you know, when you think about how that's going to affect asset prices, I know it's probably your next question. Well, how does that affect the economy? How does that affect the markets? Well, we already have, even though we have a benchmark treasury note, so a 10-year note is around 4.5%, Tom. Mm-hmm. We have auto loan and credit card delinquency rates at or near the highest they've ever been. That includes the financial crisis. That shows you how over-leveraged the economy is and how stretched we are. Just imagine if 4.5% treasury benchmark yield went to 10. Forget about 15 or 20, 10. And what would that do to the mortgage market? What would that do to the housing market? What would it do to the stock market? Mm-hmm. So we have to get a hold of both our debt problem and our inflation problem. And I don't see any hope there at all, except for outside of Kevin Warsh. Let's see if he could bring a voluntary recession / depression that would last a couple of years and suffer through it. It popped in my head. I wonder what Mr. Trump's social media would look like if Kevin Warsh was like not really cutting interest rates and slashing the balance sheet. Oh my God, the you and the cry would be it would be a cacophony from the White House and from everybody else too. But I mean, if he is another Paul Volcker, maybe we've got a shot. We'll see. I'm not counting on it.
Well, I mean, we've already seen how Trump has attacked Powell over the past couple of years, which, you know, Powell was his pick originally. So if, you know, Warsh being his pick, and if he goes against Trump, then I totally agree with your point of seeing the wall of tweets that's going to come out from Trump. But what I'm trying to wrap my head around is understanding, let's say, what breaks first in an environment where we have these escalating bond yields, right? We already know that the private credit market is being redemptions are being stopped already. There's a major problem there. Is that one of the cracks that's starting to show this, the stress in the credit markets?
So what breaks first is the credit bubble, by definition. So you just mentioned it. So rising interest rates, by definition, is a break in the credit bubble. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what I see happening.
Yeah,
and that will spill over quickly to the stock market and real estate. But if you want to look at how this progression is going to follow, I would say private credit, private equity, junk bonds, yield spreads blow out, financial conditions tighten, stock market begins to tank, and that brings real estate down with it. That's probably how it's going to flow. Listen, so we have to reconcile these, Tom. We have to reconcile these imbalances. They just can't, you cannot mm-hmm. have home price to income ratios where they are. You can't have equity markets in relation to the underlying economy stay where they are forever. So the economy now, right now, is built upon the AI bubble, the investment in AI, which used to be from cash flow. Now it's hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. So what happens when interest rates rise and you can no longer afford to raise debt to fund AI infrastructure? What would happen to these stocks? They would implode. Mm-hmm. So that's probably how you're gonna pop the bubbles will pop credit, equity, and then real estate. That's how I see it happening.
Is it possible that we're already in recession? Once we look at this retrospectively, I guess it also depends on how we're defining it, right?
Yeah, like so we have for the top one the top quintile, the top 20%, we're doing fantastic. Mm-hmm. The bottom four quintiles, that bottom 80%, has been in recession for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So the economy is working for only it's working for the very best of top wage earners. And the stock market's really working best for, and earnings are only present in AI-related investments. So if you take out AI investment, GDP plunge, and if you take out AI investment and earnings, the earnings growth is like 4 or 5%, not double digits. So that's where your bubble is. That's where all the money, and that's where all the growth is.
Michael, I remember speaking with you when obviously rates started to rise, let's say after COVID, and talking about the lag through which those rates work themselves through the economy. How do you see the lag through which, let's say, the constraints of the Strait of Hormuz and all of the downstream products and cost push inflation that puts on the economy? Is there, a kind of a slow moving train wreck coming because of those constraints due to the lack of, or the amount of energy and products taken out of the market there?
Well, we're just eating through inventories right now. So we have about, from what my research shows, we have about another month and a half or so before we just exhaust the resources there. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see oil spike inexorably. That's why you're hearing right now, both sides are like, hey, let's just get the strait open. I don't care about anything else. Let's just open the strait, get the oil prices down, mm-hmm. and get the income flowing to Iran and get bond yields lower. That's what I think that's going to happen. So that's not, at the end of the day, I think they resolve this Iran conflict. If they don't, then you're just pulling forward the day of reckoning. Mm-hmm. But even if they solve the problem, they solve the problem with the war, they have not solved the problem with insolvency, and they haven't solved the problem with inflation. You just brought down oil. You're going to be rebuilding inventories for many, many months, and infrastructure for many months, trying to get oil back down to $60 a barrel. It's just not going to happen. But inflation is not a cost pull, demand, whatever. It's about money printing. It's about more money chase. It's about the money supply growing faster than labor force plus productivity. When that happens, you get higher prices, which is everybody thinks defines as inflation. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that. I see that getting a lot where I see the, listen, here's what you have to, here's what I want you to understand. You and our audience here. The business cycle has not been repealed. We will have a recession. I don't know if it's going to be engendered from Iran, that conflict, or some other, you know, just a business cycle. It has not been repealed. We will have another recession. When that happens, the annual deficits will rise from 2 trillion plus to closer to 5 trillion. When that happens, the Federal Reserve will, in my opinion, based on history, and I hope I'm wrong when I say this, will engage in massive monetization, trillions upon trillions of dollars, bring the balance sheet close to double digits. And there will also be, in relation to what's going on with the universal, AI, universal basic income. So you'll have helicopter money and you'll have massive Fed monetization of debt. That will engender long-term interest rates to spike, despite their efforts. I think that brings down the credit markets and equities and real estate. That's how I see it happening. Mm-hmm. Can't give you a date, and I don't care about the date. Some people are stop clock investors. They'll say, hey, one day this is going to happen. One day that's going to happen. I don't do one day investing. I look at the second derivative of inflation in the context of growth. Mm-hmm. That gives me my sectors where I have five sectors in my spectrum, ranging from disinflation, rapid disinflation and deflation, all the way to hyperinflation, stagflation. And where you are in that spectrum, in those five sectors, those five buckets, depends on, you know, how many bonds do you own? Where do you own them on the yield curve? Do you short bonds? Are you long gold? Are you out of commodities? Are you long energy? What type of stocks? High beta, low beta? It's complicated and simple and beautiful. That's the best way you can participate in bull markets while they last. Listen, I might sound like a bear to you, but I'm long. I don't have one short in my entire portfolio. Not one. Mm-hmm. I believe that's going to be very temporary and it's going to change, but I'm not going to try to, you know, like, again, it's lazy investing. It's just being stop clock. Have a model, looks at the dynamics, the arcane movements in credit spreads and financial conditions, and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to make money in bull markets, but most importantly, given how extended we are, protect and profit from bear markets. That one you have to get right too. Mm-hmm.
How did your model change at the beginning of the war, Michael?
Say again?
Did or how did your model change at the beginning?
We went quickly from a kind of a neutral stance, which sector three, where the second derivative is constant, right into a reflationary positioning. Mm-hmm. So we're now between reflation and stagflation, kind of bordering those two sectors. Mm-hmm. So that means, what does that mean? That means you have no duration in the portfolio as far as in your fixed income. You're all on the short end, but you own commodities, you own energy, and you own some growth areas in the economy. That's the best way to be positioned. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, right now, as of this recording, could change tomorrow, but that's how you play this. Very hard, very, very dangerous and stupid idea to short an inflationary environment, unless that inflation is stagflation. And in that case, you still don't want to short everything. You have to be very careful what you short. Mm-hmm.
Did gold surprise you, or any other asset surprise you during that time? Or is it working? Like, what in that case, you said no. What do you think is putting the pressure on gold?
So it didn't surprise me at all. I actually took gold down because in the portfolio, we're now gold and precious metals are around 6%, mm-hmm. which when they were 15% before that. Gold does not, like, you know, gold is not an inflation hedge when it comes to, you know, that's not a statement you could just say and say, oh, inflation's rising, so I better own gold. You could destroy your portfolio that way. Gold likes falling nominal and real interest rates. That's mm-hmm. what gold really is most concerned about. Yes, there's geopolitical risk, there's the currency, but falling nominal and real interest rates. So that usually happens in recessions. Okay, we're not in one right now, at least at the headline level. We are one for 80%, for 80% of it. It's terrible. It's not funny. It's very sad, actually. But we're not in a recession, so interest rates are rising in nominal terms, and they're not really falling in real terms yet. So in other words, you would have to have inflation rates rising much quicker than nominal rates are rising, which is not really the case. That would be also a way where you have falling real interest rates. But the best environment for gold is when you see a recession, because nominal rates are falling, real interest rates are falling. That's when you want to get, overweight gold. So it didn't surprise me at all. Why? Because we have rising nominal interest rates. Mm-hmm. And inflation is thought to be very transitory by the market. That may or may not be true. It depends. Mm-hmm.
So are there very clear signals in any direction at this point, Michael? Or, this seemingly constant back and forth over peace or resumption of conflict, is that really kind of posing an issue for the markets to pick a specific direction?
Yeah, and this is very unusual, Tom. We have for the first time I can ever remember, you have to have a model that directly can predict the president's social media account.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? You don't. No one can sit up. No one can say with 100% confidence. I don't even think the president could say with 100% confidence what he's going to do the next few days. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have been since March told that this war is going to end imminently, and then middle of last week it was we're finalizing, we're dotting the I's, crossing the T's. It's going to be announced in any second, and then the market's trading up today. This is a recording the day after Memorial Day, Tuesday. On the thought of peace, imminent peace. But at that same sentence was, we're close to signing the deal, yet they're actually, kinetic actions in the Gulf. So Iran is laying mines in a strait that they're going to open, and US is attacking those boats, those vessels. So it doesn't, So anybody who could say for sure that can predict exactly what's going to happen, I was of the mind, in all honesty, that this would have to go kinetic again, and that the U.S. would occupy the strait and sections, if not all, of Iran. Mm-hmm. That's where I still have an uneasy feeling. That's where this has to end. That's the ultimate. But it could also be, hey, just both sides say, listen, I just need the strait open. I don't want to talk about anything else. Let's just open the strait and mm-hmm. and get the flow of oil moving. So Iran gets income. The United States sees oil prices fall, and that saves the midterms for everybody. That's not really a great deal for the United States.
Right. Do you think there is any saving the midterms at this point, Michael? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you had already voted for Trump, and obviously one of the big issues that many people, I think, probably voted for him based upon was the idea that he was going to be the peace president, that he was going to end all the wars, not start any new ones. Do you, let's say you in particular, feel very jaded or disappointed in Trump based on that, that Tom, action?
Tom, I don't think anybody really cares about my politics. I don't let politics affect my decisions at all. Mm-hmm. I look at the second derivative of inflation in the context of growth. I don't care who's president. Why I voted for Mr. Trump, because look at the alternative. What was your alternative? How could that possibly be better? But I loved his, I'm ambivalent, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. I love some of his instincts. Women who become, men who become women should not compete in women's sports. I mean, that to me, why is that controversial? Mm-hmm. We need to protect our borders. So the president had great instincts there. Give him a lot of credit, a lot of respect for that. Essential moves that he made. On the other hand, impugning Jerome Powell for not being enough of a dove in monetary policy and calling him all these names to try to force him into submission was terrible. What happened to DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency? Where are we there? I thought we were slashing government and balancing budgets, balancing the trade deficit and balancing budgets. We're on the other end of the spectrum there. What about not getting involved in overseas? How about not being the policeman of the world? These are all libertarian, talking points, which I espouse. But so I'm disappointed in some things, and I'm very proud of other things. That's how I stand. But none of those things affect the way I manage money.
Of course. So, but Michael, in inherent in that, that doesn't that make you, or what is your analysis based upon those actions? Do you think that this, that the Republican Party has hope in November for? Because, I mean, obviously, the, as you said, the earlier, the alternative in the last election wasn't great at all.
I think you've lost. I would say the odds are highly in favor of losing the House. Unfortunately, redistricting could make that a little bit more opaque. But the people who, the average American going to fill up their gas tank and going to the grocery store, has to be completely disenfranchised with this inflation. And here's where I think Trump could do a lot better job, if I can give him any advice at all. Stop the hyperbole and stop being a salesperson. Tell people the truth. Stop saying inflation's zero. Inflation's non-existent. Or affordability is a word made up by CNN or something like that. I mean, people are, go fill up your tank and go to the grocery store. People are really hurting on that bottom four quintiles. They're really, really suffering. And they would like to say, hey, I went to war for our future. I went to war to make sure that, you know, Iran didn't have a nuclear bomb. Yes, you're suffering. It's temporary. But be a little more honest with people and open, because people aren't that stupid. They're going to vote with their pocketbooks, and it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good in November, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Again, because your alternative is not any better.
So, Michael, is there anything that that gives you hope for the states at this point?
Is there anything that gives me hope? Well, I'm a religious person. I believe in Jesus, so I'm always at home, filled with hope. Economically speaking, I have a lot of hope. Like I said, in Mr. Warsh. I would love for him to reduce the Fed's footprint in the economy. I'd love a massive infusion of markets in the discovery of price, especially the cost of money. That would be lovely. I have a lot of faith in the American people too. In freedom. Let's see if we can get that back while we still have a chance.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Michael. Well, I appreciate you walking us through all these ideas. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
Yeah. If you're somebody who's in this typical 60-40 portfolio, depending on your age, your target date, retirement age, and your portfolio has a mixture of bonds across all durations and all scopes, including junk bonds, you got to get out of that. You're going to be in a situation like 2022. Where both stocks and bonds go down in price, so yields are rising, and you're going to get killed in both your duration in your bonds and in your stock portfolio. Do not think that we are not in highly unusual times. We are in the most overvalued stock market in history, the most overvalued real estate market in history, both built and erected upon a gigantic credit bubble. Active management is the way to go.
Excellent. Of course, for anybody that wants to check out any more of Michael's work, writing, podcasts, things like that, that's all available at pentoport.com. Michael, thanks so much for your time today.
Pleasure to see you, Tom.